From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, do they want to take us down? Crisis by Design with John Truman Wolf. Get ready for that. Well, here's what's happening. Well, a series of earthquakes just hitting Southern California, the biggest so far, 5.7. Not many people here at the old studios felt it at all. BP took measures to cut costs in the weeks before this catastrophic blowout in the Gulf of Mexico as it dealt with one problem after another, prompting a BP engineer to describe the doomed rig as a nightmare well, according to internal documents. The comment by BP engineer Brian Morrell came in an email April 14th, 6 days before the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded that killed 11 people and has sent tens of millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf in the nation's worst environmental disaster. The email was among dozens of internal documents released by the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is investigating the explosion and its aftermath. And President Barack Obama has promised that things are going to return to normal along the stricken Gulf Coast, and the region's fouled waters will be in better shape than before the catastrophe. I highly doubt that. He declared Gulf seafood safe to eat and said his administration was redoubling inspections and monitoring to make sure that it stays that way. Captain Kelly Sweeney has been staying that way, monitoring this situation since it began many, many weeks ago. Kelly, what's the latest out there?
Ahoy, George. Well, right now all eyes are on a low-pressure system that's about 1,000 miles east of the Bahamas, moving about 360 miles a day, that the National Hurricane Center is giving a medium-level chance of turning into a tropical cyclone, which is a precursor to a hurricane. And the commercial shipping is now starting to become impacted by the oil spill. There are 30 decontamination centers that have been set up for ships along Louisiana and the Gulf Coast that are set up to basically wash the hulls of vessels that have gone through the oil spill.
I was going to say, are they trying to go around the oil spill, or can they just go right through it?
Well, the ships are trying to go around it when possible, but sometimes you just can't do it because there are so many oil rigs out there. There's like almost 4,000 out there, George, in the Gulf. There are so many that it's like threading a needle there, going through. You have to go in what's called safety fairways that are just very narrow fairways, and they are the only safe places that deeper draft vessels can go in and out of.
Kelly, what's going on with the cleanup activity?
The cleanup continues. There's a big concern right now that hurricane season is going to start impacting the recovery vessels that are the oil spill recovery. But right now, by the latest reports, about 30% of the oil on the surface is being recovered, which is about to be expected.
Quick reaction to President Obama's statement that those waters will be in better shape than before the catastrophe.
Well, George,
How can that be?
I think that you're 100% right, George. It's going to be decades, if not generations, before that's the case. People are going to be impacted for a long time, and if changes are going to be made, and he said that he's going to try to have this never happen again, I would like to see these vessels registered under the U.S. flag, where they have to be inspected by the U.S. Coast Guard regularly, and that they are not allowed, these companies are not allowed to circumvent our laws and have more lax oversight.
Absolutely. Later, Captain Kelly Sweeney, thanks so much. You know, remember what I've always said, who benefits, right? Well, the U.S. military has discovered nearly $1 trillion in untapped mineral deposits in Afghanistan, a development they say could alter the Afghan economy and perhaps the entire war itself. Afghan geologists apparently protected decades-old Soviet geological surveys showing the routes to billions of dollars worth of copper, lithium, iron, and gold reserves. Keep your eyes on that one. The cost of fixing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now those are the mortgage companies that last year bought or guaranteed three-quarters of all U.S. home loans, will be at least $160 billion and could grow to as much as $1 trillion after the biggest bailout in American history. Catherine Austin Fitz, she knows all about these things. She's with us now on Coast to Coast. Catherine, how deep can Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get?
Well, George, if the Freddie and Fannie are basically, their economic performance depends on the income that flows to support residential households all across America. So if we as a nation are intentionally implementing policies that cause that income to fall, then the value of their portfolios are going to fall, and the amount the federal government has to pay to keep them going is going to rise. So, for example, if you have the Gulf oil spill, you shut down a huge amount of small business activity and economic activity all along the Gulf, then all of those businesses and all of those households lose income, and so, you know, then the value of the mortgage-backed securities go down in value. But really, there are two problems with Fannie Mae. That's one of them. The other is there's so much fraud embedded at this point within the portfolio and the derivatives on top of them.
Sure.
That the issue really is, how do we de-link the taking care of the debt holders from doing what makes sense in terms of working out the mortgages and starting to make economies locally work again? And so you have one group in Washington saying, let's privatize because that's what local economies need. You have another saying, oh, let's nationalize because that's what bondholders and derivative holder needs. And the reality is we need to do both. We need to de-link the debt from the mortgages, and you're going to require a whole group of the mortgage entities in Washington, FHA, HUD, Ginnie Mae, Treasury, and Federal Reserve. How do you put together a plan to nationalize the debt to protect the bondholders and then proceed? What you really need to do is spin out the mortgage portfolio to 50 states. Some states may choose to spin it back down to the counties. And you could even do debt for equity swaps. There are many different ways to do it, but you need to get the mortgages and the servicing of those mortgages, whether they're performing or defaulted, into hands where they can be worked out along with the other private debt, the municipal, and the change in government policies that have to work. And there are many ways to get that portfolio, you know, not costing the federal government money, in fact, in the long run, making the federal government money. But what you're going to need to do is you're going to have to realign mortgage financing with productivity. Right now, the banks don't care if drug dealers overrun a neighborhood because they're making money on the mortgages no matter what.
Exactly.
Same with the bondholders. So you're going to have to have a fundamental realignment with how you finance places with good behavior. And it can be done. But I think we're going to have to, you know, what we can't do is we can't have the centralized BP spill response in the mortgage area. And, that, you know, that's what we're seeing. It's the same kind of, you know, Soviet Union response. And so the question is, how do you get this stuff back down on the ground? And how do you get fundamental economic productivity kickstarted by doing that? I used to have a deputy at HUD who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. And that's how we have to work out Fannie and Freddie.
Exactly what we need to do. Thanks, Catherine. Catherine's website will be part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Some of the world's most popular blood pressure pills may slightly increase your risk of getting cancer. Slightly. Doctors say it's way too soon to ditch the drugs. In an analysis of 5 previous studies following about 60,000 patients, experts found a link between people taking medicines known as angiotensin receptor blockers and cancer. The drugs are taken by millions of people worldwide for conditions like high blood pressure, heart problems, and diabetic kidney disease. In the analysis, researchers found that people who took the drugs had about a 1% higher risk of getting cancer than people who weren't on the drugs, and this included a whole range of cancers, prostate, breast, and a noticeable spike in lung cancer. Americans get the most medical radiation in the world. The U.S. accounts for half of the most advanced procedures that use radiation, and the average American's dose has grown sixfold over the last couple of decades. Too much radiation raises the risk of cancer. That risk is growing because people in everyday situations are getting imaging tests far too often. Be careful. Well, on this Flag Day, a reminder that on June 14, 1775, our country's founding fathers established the Continental Army in preparation for revolution against the British. In that regard, the Army has been around longer than the United States itself. And what began as a mostly untrained group of 15,000 farmers and craftsmen, it has now grown to become one of the largest, most elite, and technologically advanced fighting forces in the world. The Army's mission today remains much the same as it was more than two centuries ago, to champion the cause of freedom on our shores and abroad. The moon might be wetter than previously thought, according to scientists. A U.S.-led team analyzing a mineral in lunar rocks picked up by the Apollo space missions and in a lunar meteorite found in North Africa. The scientists found that there are at least 100 times more water in the moon's minerals than they had previously believed. Over the weekend, Richard C. Hoagland sent me a video of this incredible Hayabusa re-entering the atmosphere. A team of scientists flew to the Australian outback and recovered a Japanese space capsule that they hope contains asteroid samples, providing clues into the evolution of the solar system. The Hayabusa Explorer returned to Earth overnight after a seven-year, multi-billion-mile journey, burning apart on re-entry in a spectacular fireball just after jettisoning the capsule. It was the first time a spacecraft successfully landed on an asteroid and returned to Earth. Up next, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, sent me an email this weekend. And Richard, I could just sense your enthusiasm when you were looking at that video and you sent a little bit to me. It was amazing, huh?
Well, as we teased on Friday night, this mission, this Japanese mission to this little asteroid, which is around 1,500 feet across, really tiny compared to some of the other objects out there, is more than I think is being discussed in the press. Would that be a surprise?
It would not be, yeah.
So, yeah, this video, which was shot by the Australian Defense Force over the Woomera Test Range, which is in northeastern Australia, and I first encountered the Woomera Test Range in the works of Arthur C. Clarke, who based one of his novels there. It's in the middle of nowhere in the outback of Australia. In fact, when this thing landed successfully after it jettisoned the little capsule, and the capsule came through the atmosphere, re-entering at something like almost 8 miles per second, which is probably the fastest that anything has come into the Earth's atmosphere and survived and been picked up.
Yeah.
It landed in the desert in the middle of this test range. At first light, they sent out helicopters, and they found it with the parachute. In fact, they pre-dawn, because there's a picture on the web showing from the helicopter the shot of the capsule lying on the desert floor with the parachute kind of draped off to one side and a whole bunch of scrub around it. Looks a bit like New Mexico. And what was really interesting is that they then reported that they brought in, after sunrise, a group of local Aboriginal elders by helicopter.
Why?
They said in the piece that I was reading on I think it's Reuters, that it was to verify that no sacred sites had been damaged.
Ah.
A defense spokesman then, I'm quoting from the story, said the indigenous leaders then cleared the way for the capsule to be recovered later on Monday. But frankly, I'm a little bit skeptical of that explanation. I mean, look, I said on this show Friday night that, Itokawa, which is the name of the asteroid.
And it reached it in 2005.
Yeah.
Sounds like it was forever.
It's been 7 years since thing, you know, seven tetrahedral years since they launched this thing. They landed on it twice, touching down very gently, hoping they got samples. I'll get back to that in a second, in 2005. And then because they had all kinds of equipment problems, the ion engines quit, the attitude control didn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, they had every conceivable problem, and they overcame every one of them, and they got this thing back successfully last night. So the elders, if I'm right, if this thing, this little asteroid that this Japanese probe touched down on, by the way, Hayabusa means falcon.
Okay.
Which, of course, is part of the Osirian mythology out of Egypt. We'll get back to that in a minute, too. If the elders actually were brought in, I think that the Reuters story is a cover story.
I think because the elders, the Aboriginal elders, have their own histories of the human race when it did much more interesting things. And when we ran around out there and lived out there and all this, I think they were bringing the elders to basically sanction a sacred piece of their own history before it was whisked away
to
a laboratory in Japan.
You may be right. When do they pop open this thing?
They're saying it's going to be in the next 24 hours. Now, the big mystery, of course, is we don't really know that this little probe brought back anything.
That's right.
Because during the sequence back in 2005, cast your mind back, you know, several years, half a decade, does not seem that long.
My gosh.
By remote control, they were trying to gently lower the spacecraft, the main bus, the big spacecraft that weighed something like 1,500 pounds, to within a few meters of this asteroid. And then they were supposed to kick up by firing a bullet, literally several mechanical bullets, spring-loaded, were supposed to be fired downward into the asteroid.
To kick up some dust,
to
right?
To kick up dust, because the asteroid basically has no gravity. So if you hit it with something, a bunch of stuff will spray out, and they were hoping they would collect that material in this capsule, seal it, bring the whole spacecraft back to Earth over, you know, back in 2007, I think they were originally intending to come home. And that all failed. They had to redo the plan. So when they looked at the telemetry, it looked as if the firing mechanism had not fired. But as a weirdness, the entire spacecraft literally sat down like a, you know, resting bird.
Sure.
On the surface of this asteroid. It was never intended to land.
Without gravity.
Well, it's very minute.
Yeah.
So it's more like a rendezvous. It sat down for twice, I think, for several hours. And they're hoping that the very act of this thing crunching down on that powdery surface would have kicked up some dust that the collectors, which were open, received some sample when they sealed them up and brought it back to Earth. Anyway, all of that is a big mystery because we really don't know that there's anything in this capsule that they brought back.
Now, they even tried to grab some pebbles, didn't they?
Well, no, because they didn't have the capability of grabbing anything. It was all this little ballistic rifle bullet thingy fired down into the soil, kicking up a cloud of material, and then the sample of material would kind of waft into, through ballistic action, the sampling device, which would then close. And then they would bring the spacecraft back to Earth. They separated the capsule as they planned, which was amazing given all the weird technical problems they had with this mission to begin with, and that's what landed safely in the desert last night, and which the Aboriginal elders somehow had to be brought in to do something with.
What incredible technology, though, Richard.
Well, come on. The Japanese are pretty good at robotics and remote control stuff. I mean, I'm fascinated by the workarounds. The big deal, of course, is will they tell us, A, if there is soil in there, is this a big shaggy dog story so they can have plausible deniability to say, well, we're sorry, but nothing came back? Or will they tell us the truth and tell us, yeah, we got material and this is what it's composed of?
Mm-hmm.
Or C, will they tell us the truth and say, we got material and this is what it's composed of? And, oh, by the way, there looks like there's high-tech components and refined metal. I'm serious, George.
We've got some transistors in here.
I'm absolutely serious, yes. So you have those three options. You've got the, oops, nothing happened, you know, move along, nothing to see. Or, oh, we've got ancient pristine material from the origin of the solar system. Yeah, right. Or the realistic scenario, which is based on the imagery. If you go to the websites, the Japanese websites, and you look at the close-ups, of the really stunning close-ups they got of this asteroid, there are things there that do not look like natural rocks. They're too geometric. They're too spiky. There's one thing on the edge which looks like a pipe sticking up. Now, rocks do not form pipe-like structures sticking up a couple of hundred feet.
Well, that's true. Richard, I'm going to keep you around for some phone calls, and we're going to continue to chat. I want to get your take on what scientists are saying now that the they think they have at least 100 times more water in the moon's minerals than they had previously believed. We'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland, heads up the enterprisemission.com. He's also our science advisor, so we'll be right back. Ah, yes, and we've got a real pioneer of science with us tonight. Richard C. Hoagland will be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls, continue the chat with Richard C. Ah, the phones are smoking hot for Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, what do you think of this? 100 times more water in the moon's minerals than they previously thought.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean,
of course not. You've been telling us the moon had water before they even told us.
And this is deep water. This is the intrinsic water from the moon's formation. The stuff they were reporting, you know, about 6-8 months ago is on the surface. This is in the actual mineralogy from the analysis of the samples that the Apollo astronauts brought back. Look, all this is setting us up for the fact that we can live off the moon. We can set up colonies. We can set up bases. We can set up an industrial infrastructure. So, of course, what's the United States doing? It's never going to go back to the moon.
Not going.
Everybody else is going. I mean, look, I am now at the point of being so disgusted with the Obama administration.
What? You?
Let me repeat. I am at the point now of being so disgusted with the Obama administration. I'll tell you what has kind of tipped me over the edge. And I know you want to talk about other things. I want to talk about the Gulf. I have breaking news tonight that is very important for people to hear.
Hit us with your best shot.
And I would like to bring Robin on in a few minutes because she was down there, you know, risking her life, her health, to do things for people on the ground. And because she was there, I want her to report firsthand what she saw and what she did not see and who she interacted with, because that's an important part of the rest of the story. Here's the breaking news. Everybody in the media, MSNBC, Fox, CNN, CBS, ABC, all of them, are treating this like a catastrophe that is over except for the cleanup. I have news. It is not over. In fact, it may not even have begun. I have reports tonight from very credible inside sources. When I say inside, I mean really inside. Inside BP, mm-hmm. Inside the U.S. government, that surface ships using GPS and depth finders have recorded in the last month the emergence of a bubble under the Gulf of Mexico floor, something between 15 and 20 miles across.
This is serious.
And tens of feet high. Now, this is preliminary because that measurement, as you know, GPS is degraded for civilian use. So we don't have access to the highest possible resolution of GPS data from the military side, or if it exists, they're not telling us. But this creation of a bubble around the wellhead, the Deepwater Horizon's, you know, BOP sitting on the ocean floor.
Is this a gas bubble?
This would be a gas bubble. Now, let me go through the physics of what's going on. They started early this year drilling this well. Several geologists, one in particular, who became president of one of the companies that basically runs around the world and puts out well catastrophes.
Okay.
In fact, this individual who you should have on the show, and I have made preliminary steps in moving in that direction, and he has agreed under certain conditions to be a guest. This is the guy who was in charge of putting out all the well fires in Kuwait. Remember how they were saying it would take 10 years?
He's like a Red Adair, right?
He's better than Red Adair. So he's got a proven track record. Anyway, he was writing documents and reports scathingly critical of the idea of doing exactly the kind of deep water drilling the BP did, because there are no safety precautions at those depths. Not just the depth of the drilling. I mean, everybody's making a big deal of the mile underwater, right?
Right.
That's not the real problem. The water is the problem, because if something bad goes really, really wrong, then the water will take it everywhere in the world if you can't turn it off. It's like, remember Fantasia?
Yeah.
Where Mickey Mouse couldn't
stop
the bubble
machine? It just kept coming more and more.
It goes more and more and more. Well, this guy, this geologist, whose name I won't use at the moment, but I will privately tell you who and how to get hold of him and all that, he wrote documents a couple of years ago, saying that what they were planning to do was nuts because the formations, which is the technical term for the geology under the Gulf, probably could not safely withstand the pressures from opening up a deep, deep well. They went down 22,500 feet for this well. That's miles.
Unbelievable.
At those depths, the pressures are, get this, write this down, something like on the order of 100,000 pounds per square inch.
Jeez, it's 4.5 miles deep.
Exactly. You cannot contain, with current engineering, pressures of 100,000 pounds PSI. Just can't. So this was an accident almost set up to inevitably happen. Then we look at what they did, and they did everything wrong. At every decision point, as the documents are coming out, as Congress is making more and more of this stuff available through the hearing process, which has been going on over the last week, we find that BP did everything wrong, as did Transocean, when they were overruled and exceeded to being overruled by a BP guy on site who said, oh, we're going to take out the drilling mud and put in seawater, and, oh, we're not going to put in spacers to keep the well centered, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like the perfect storm, George, of catastrophes of catastrophe could in fact happen, because as the well blew, what happens is you have mud and oil and gas, a lot of gas, rushing up at the speed of sound up that four-mile pipe. That pipe can't stand it. What happened is the casing literally was blown away. The cement was
shook loose.
Was basically blown out of the way, and you've got a straight line to the top for gas under almost 100,000 PSI.
Oh, my God. It could blow up, couldn't it?
What that does is it causes what's called cavitation, which is supersonic bubbles, which ship propellers run into all the time. That's why you have to replace propellers, because as the props spin in the water, particularly on big ships, Navy ships, whatever,
right,
it basically is a supersonic implosion that basically gouges out little craters in even vanadium steel.
Could you also not sink if you go right over a bubble like that?
Well, exactly. You would, if a bubble came up, which is what I'm going to get to, you would sink every rig and every ship in the region for miles around this wellhead.
Which was a possibility for the Bermuda Triangle when
Precisely.
They talked about ships. Yeah.
Exactly. There are occasions where we think ships have encountered hydrates that went to gas.
And they just disappear.
And because the water no longer has the same buoyancy, and so the ship founders and sinks.
Yeah.
And everybody dies because you can't swim in that either.
You just go down instantly.
You go down and you die. And so we're looking at potentially thousands of people on all those ships and those rigs that are now trying to solve this by drilling two wells, which, by the way, is also exactly the wrong thing to do. Here's the worst-case scenario. As that well, you know, gushing up at that enormous pressure reached the top, all the way up through we don't know how many layers of geology through 4.5 miles. It could be as many as 50 or 60 different layers of limestone, sand lenses, mm-hmm. gas pockets, oil pockets, different oil reservoirs, which they went down through
all,
on the way down.
All pouring into this.
All being pressurized by this 100,000 PSI infinite fountain at the base, at the bottom of this reservoir. This is like turning on the bubble machine. You know, think Lawrence Welk and having no way to turn it off. That's why, by the way, they have not capped the well.
And I got to tell you, if you believe in the abiotic oil theory, like I do, it may never run out.
Well, there is a guy, another guy I want you to have on as a guest. His name is Chris Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U. He has delivered two peer-reviewed papers in the last year, one in 2008, one in 2009, on how abiotic oil could be processed and produced right now in this well-stacked series of formations. And no one is telling us whether they're looking at new oil or old oil, and there's a way to tell. So I need to get you that contact info so you can have him on, because he's a heavy hitter, and he was, again, one of the few ahead of the pack predicting things like this could happen before they occurred. Well, let me go back to the worst-case scenario. If this well, as it's pressurizing these upper-level strata, were to create cracks in the ocean floor at the top level, which appears to be happening
it
if you listen to Senator Nelson.
That's right.
That's right. We listen to the NOAA guys on the underwater plumes.
Little fissures out there.
Fissures, yes. And they try to cap this well, or the final rupture occurs, you could have the most horrendous gas explosion 50 miles off Louisiana that you can imagine. Think Mount St. Helens underwater.
Underwater.
What that would do is create a cloud of incredible toxic material, which would then drift with the winds over the shore where there are millions of people.
What about a tsunami?
The next step is you would get a tsunami moving at between 400 to 600 miles an hour all across in an expanding ring out from where this event occurred, and the most vulnerable state for that to occur, because nothing is more than 6 inches high, is Florida. It isn't Louisiana. It isn't Mississippi or Alabama. It's Florida. Now, this is what we need to do to solve this problem and to alert ordinary people who are not being taken into account by either government or BP at all. We need what's something called the mud dog data or the mud log data.
What is that?
Every well that's drilled, you know, it's drilling is a messy process. You got to send a mechanical drill spinning down, crunching through level after level after level to get to the depths where the oil is. They keep a record, a physical archive of the rocks, the material, the other oil samples. Every foot down is recorded, but it's proprietary. And the only people who have looked at the mud dog data, as it's called, by the riggers on these rigs, is BP. Is BP.
Hiding it.
And they are hiding it. They've been hiding everything. They won't even tell us how much oil is gushing out of here. So what I want the Coast audience to do tonight is to send an email to Barack Obama before his damn speech tomorrow night and tell him that nothing makes any sense if we are only looking at the beginning of the catastrophe and not the cleanup. And to know this, we need independent geologists, both in government and outside of government, with access to this mud log data or mud dog data. And it needs to be not just from this well, but from all the other wells in the Gulf. There's 40,000 wells, George, and each one of those wells has a mud log, which will tell us the strata, the strength, what's in it, the age. In other words, you've got a CAT scan of the entire bottom of the Gulf. So if we're building toward a crisis, this will tell us if, in fact, people are going to have to leave the Gulf Coast to protect themselves and their families with enough warning. Now, it's not going to happen tomorrow. We've got weeks and maybe months as this pressure seeps through these overlying formations.
Let's hope it doesn't happen.
But it is a ticking time bomb, which in the worst-case scenario could catch a lot of people unawares, because the people that we are trusting to tell us the truth are telling us nothing but damn lies and, you know, giving us Band-Aids and solving soothing comments like the president who said, oh, we're going to clean it up so it's better than before. Give me a break. Now, number two, we need a network of buoys put in place immediately, like they put in place in the Coral Sea after the tsunami in 2004, to tell us with sophisticated satellite positioning and sophisticated echo sounders, either from NOAA or from the USGS or the US Navy. All these people have warehouses filled with these buoys. They can deploy them in a couple of days. We need to have a moment-by-moment internet live display of what's happening to this bubble on the Gulf floor, so ordinary Americans, the ones who pay the taxes, the ones who keep this government going, the ones who believe in the flag and the Constitution, they have a chance, a fighting chance, to see what's going on and get out of the way if it really hits the fan.
All right. Go get Robin.
I'd like to bring on Robin.
I'm here, Richard.
There you
I'm
go,
here.
Robin, you were out there about a week or so ago, weren't you?
I came back. I got home, I think, 4:30 Monday morning, last Monday.
Well, describe the scene for those of us who aren't there.
Okay, there is major concern amongst the people. I went there so I could talk to the people. I haven't seen any representation on the news of anybody other than a politician or BP people or police. And the people are very concerned. The people there do not feel they have time. And this is everyone I spoke with in Texas, Louisiana and in Alabama. And they are very concerned with the hurricane season beginning. They are very concerned that one woman's dad is a commercial fisherman. He's being paid right now to not fish, being told that he cannot take what are supposed to be the safe fish out of the water to even eat because they need them for restocking.
That's right.
Now, if there's any way that you can determine that these are safe and those are bad.
How would you know unless you ate it, right?
Well, they're in the same body of water. So, you know, it boggles the mind. This is so widespread, and the impact for how many millions of people make their living on the Gulf Coast.
Isn't this amazing the way this happens right on top of this economic crunch we're in? And you know, you get that feeling we're going to pull out of it, we're going to pull out, and then bang, something else happens.
And they want to open the borders. You know, I mean, the craziness, the people there are so, I you know, distraught or on the verge of almost being hopeless. And how can they bring Wackenhut back into the New Orleans area after what happened with Katrina?
That's frightening. All right, Robin, give me another report later. Let's take a few calls here with Richard and wrap this hour up. Let's go east to the Rockies. Corky in Rochester, New York. Go ahead, Corky.
Hello. I'm glad I finally got through.
Good.
Richard, about a month after the earthquake happened, they come out with a report, a small blip, and I haven't heard nothing after that, about the molten core of the earth shifted 30 feet. Have you heard that?
No, I've not, and I don't think we could possibly measure 30 feet over a distance of 4,000 miles with seismology.
What a disaster, though, Richard. You had mentioned a frustration with this administration. Why are you frustrated? What did they do wrong?
James Carville has been on media, on CNN, because that's where he's being paid to be a consultant these days.
Yeah, that's right.
Every night, basically the raging Cajun, who, as I said on Friday, is my new best friend because he's one of the few people expressing the outrage that nothing appears to be done. You've got thousands of miles of coastline when you count all those little bays and estuaries along the Gulf Coast. You've got the richest seafood region of the world. You've got oil and gas drilling at great depth under conditions that have not changed in 30, 40 years in terms of safety technology.
I don't think they know what to do.
But they shouldn't be doing what they're doing if they don't know what they're doing. You understand?
I know it.
And you're right. This is the perfect storm, and I am very concerned that unless we get this mudlog data put on the Internet so we all get to see it, and all the independent geologists, I mean, I know a few, like Ron Nix has been on this program. He'd be competent to look at this and say, okay, this formation will break on such and such a time under such and such a load. This formation will stand. This gas will come up. I mean, we need an independent review. This needs to be treated as an invasion, as a war, like World War III, and instead we're mucking around at the edges of the sea, claiming, oh, everything will be fine. We'll seal this in August, and then we can all go back to it. We'll be better than before. Again, give me a break.
Charles Seif's coming on this week, Richard. He's saying you can't nuke it, you can't bomb it. So without that,
what needs to be done? And Chris Landau has a very interesting prescription. He says you need to drill 8 to 10 wells in a radius around 1,500 feet around the current well.
And hopefully take that pressure.
You don't drill into the drill stem because you don't want to.
No, you don't want to do that.
Provide another conduit to the surface for this rushing oil. Because the so-called relief wells, if they actually hit the current riser, you'll triple what's coming up.
Well, that's all we need. Thanks. Richard C. Hoagland, that's his update. We'll be back in a moment with John Truman Wolf, Crisis by Design, the untold story of the global financial coup. Wait till you hear this story.